Aphrodite sat, or held court, rather, in a wicker peacock chair. She poured tea and served cakes without getting a speck on her clothes, her posture always perfect, her smile dazzling. Annabeth hated her more and more the longer they sat.
"Oh, my sweet girls," the goddess said, "I do love Charleston. The weddings I've attended in this gazebo, they bring tears to my eyes. And the elegant balls in the days of the old South, oh, they were lovely. Many of these mansions still have statues of me in their gardens, though they called me Venus."
"Which are you?" Annabeth asked. "Venus or Aphrodite?" The goddess sipped her tea. Her eyes sparkled mischievously.
"Annabeth Chase, you've grown into quite a beautiful young lady. You really should do something with your hair, though. And Hazel Levesque, your clothes."
"My clothes?" Hazel looked down at her rumpled denim, not self-consciously, but baffled, as if she couldn't imagine what was wrong with them. "Mother," Piper said, "you're embarrassing me."
"Well, I don't see why," the goddess said. "Just because you don't appreciate my fashion tips, Piper, doesn't mean the others won't. I could do a quick makeover for Annabeth and Hazel, perhaps silk ball gowns like mine."
"Mother!"
"Fine," Aphrodite sighed. "To answer your question, Annabeth, I am both Aphrodite and Venus. Unlike many of my fellow Olympians, I changed hardly at all from one age to the other. In fact, I like to think I haven't aged a bit."
Her fingers fluttered around her face appreciatively.
"Love is love, after all. Whether you're Greek or Roman, this civil war won't affect me as much as it will the others."
Wonderful, Annabeth thought. Her own mother, the most level-headed Olympian, was reduced to a raving, vicious scatterbrain in a subway station. And of all the gods who might help them, the only ones not affected by the Greek-Roman schism seemed to be Aphrodite, Nemesis, and Dionysus. Love, revenge, wine. Very helpful. Hazel nibbled a sugar cookie.
"We're not in a war yet, my lady." "Oh, dear Hazel," Aphrodite folded her fan. "Such optimism. Yet you have heart-rending days ahead of you. Of course war is coming. Love and war always go together. They are the peaks of human emotion. Evil and good, beauty and ugliness."
She smiled at Annabeth as if she knew what Annabeth had been thinking earlier about the old South. Hazel set down her sugar cookie. She had a few crumbs on her chin, and Annabeth liked the fact that Hazel either didn't know or didn't care.
"What do you mean?" Hazel asked. "Heart-rending days."
The goddess laughed as if Hazel were a cute puppy.
"Well, Annabeth could give you some idea. I once promised to make her love life interesting, and didn't I?"
Annabeth almost snapped the handle off her teacup. For years her heart had been torn. First there was Lou Castellan, her first crush, who had seen her only as a little sister. Then he'd turned evil and decided he liked her right before he died. Next came Percy, who was infuriating but sweet, yet he had seemed to be falling for another girl named Rachel, and then he almost died several times. Finally, Annabeth had gotten Percy to herself, only to have him vanish for 6 months and lose his memory. "Interesting," Annabeth said, "is a mild way of putting it."
"Well, I can't take credit for all your troubles," the goddess said, "but I do love twists and turns in a love story. Oh, all of you are such excellent stories. I mean, girls, you do me proud."
"Mother," Piper said, "is there a reason you're here?"
"Hmm? Oh, you mean besides the tea? I often come here. I love the view, the food, the atmosphere. You can just smell the romance and heartbreak in the air, can't you? Centuries of it."
She pointed to a nearby mansion.
"Do you see that rooftop balcony? We had a party there the night the American Civil War began. The shelling of Fort Sumter."
"That's it," Annabeth remembered. "The island and the harbor. That's where the first fighting of the Civil War happened? The Confederates shelled the Union troops and took the fort."
"Oh, such a Party, Aphrodite said. A string quartet and all the men in their elegant new officers' uniforms. The women's dresses, you should have seen them. I danced with Ares. Or was he Mars? I'm afraid I was a little giddy. And the beautiful bursts of light across the harbor, the roar of the cannons giving the men an excuse to put their arms around their frightened sweethearts.
Annabeth's tea was cold. She hadn't eaten anything, but she felt like she wanted to throw up. You're talking about the beginning of the bloodiest war in U.S. history. Over 600,000 people died. More Americans than in World War I and World War II combined.
And the refreshments, Aphrodite continued. Ah, they were divine. General Beauregard himself made an appearance. He was such a scoundrel. He was on his second wife then, but you should have seen the way he looked at Lisbeth Cooper.
Mother! Piper tossed her scone to the pigeons.
Yes, sorry, the goddess said. To make the story short, I'm here to help you girls. I doubt you'll be seeing Hera much. Your little quest has hardly made her welcome in the throne room, and the other gods are rather indisposed, as you know, torn between their Roman and Greek sides. Some more than others.
Aphrodite fixed her gaze on Annabeth.
I suppose you've told your friends about your falling out with your mother?
Heat rose to Annabeth's cheeks. Hazel and Piper looked at her curiously. Falling out? Hazel asked. An argument, Annabeth said. It's nothing.
Nothing, the goddess said. Well, I don't know about that. Athena was the most Greek of all goddesses, the patron of Athens, after all. When the Romans took over, they adopted Athena after a fashion. She became Minerva, the goddess of crafts and cleverness. But the Romans had other war gods who were more to their taste. More reliably Roman, like Bellona.
Rhaena's mom, Piper muttered.
Yes, indeed,
the goddess agreed.
I had a lovely talk with Rhaena a while back, right here in the park. And the Romans had Mars, of course, and later there was Mithras. Not even properly Greek or Roman, but the legionnaires were crazy about his cult. I always found him crass and terribly nouveau dû, personally. At any rate, the Romans quite sidelined poor Athena. They took away most of her military importance. The Greeks never forgave the Romans for that insult. Neither did Athena.
Annabeth's ears buzzed. The mark of Athena, she said. It leads to a statue, doesn't it? It leads to the statue. Aphrodite smiled.
You are clever, like your mother. Understand, though, your siblings, the children of Athena, have been searching for centuries. None has succeeded in recovering the statue. In the meantime, they've been keeping alive the Greek feud with the Romans. Every civil war, so much bloodshed and heartbreak, has been orchestrated largely by Athena's children.
That's, Annabeth wanted to say, impossible, but she remembered Athena's bitter words in Grand Central Station, the burning hatred in her eyes.
Romantic, Aphrodite offered. Yes, I suppose it is.
But, Annabeth tried to clear the fog from her brain. The mark of Athena, how does it work? Is it a series of clues? Or a trail set by Athena? Aphrodite looked politely bored.
I couldn't say. I don't believe Athena created the mark consciously. If she knew where her statue was, she'd simply tell you where to find it. No, I guess the mark is more like a spiritual trail of breadcrumbs. It's a connection between the statue and the children of the goddess. The statue wants to be found, you see, but it can only be freed by the most worthy.
And for thousands of years, Annabeth said, no one has managed. Hold on, Piper said. What statue are we talking about? The goddess laughed.
Oh, I'm sure Annabeth can fill you in. At any rate, the clue you need is close by. A map of sorts left by the children of Athena in 1861. A remembrance that will start you on your path once you reach Rome. But as you said, Annabeth Chase, no one has ever succeeded in following the mark of Athena to its end. There you will face your worst fear.
the fear of every child of Athena. And even if you survive, how will you use your reward? For war or for peace? Annabeth was glad for the tablecloth, because under the table her legs were trembling. This map, she said, where is it?
Guys!
Hazel pointed to the sky. Circling above the palmetto trees were two large eagles. Higher up, descending rapidly, was a flying chariot pulled by Pegasi. Apparently Leo's diversion with Buford the End Table hadn't worked. At least not for long. Aphrodite spread butter on a muffin as if she had all the time in the world.
Oh, the map is at Fort Sumter, of course.
She pointed her butter knife toward the island across the harbor.
It looks like the Romans have arrived to cut you off. I'd get back to your ship in a hurry if I were you. Would you care for some tea cakes to go?
Chapter 19. Annabeth. They didn't make it to the ship. Halfway across the dock, three giant eagles descended in front of them. Each deposited a Roman commando in purple and denim with glittering gold armor, sword, and shield. The eagles flew away, and the Roman in the middle, who was scrawnier than the others, raised his visor.
"Surrender to Rome!"
Octavian shrieked. Hazel drew her cavalry sword and grumbled,
"Fat chance, Octavian!"
Annabeth cursed under her breath. By himself, the skinny augur wouldn't have bothered her. But the two other guys looked like seasoned warriors, a lot bigger and stronger than Annabeth wanted to deal with, especially since Piper and she were armed only with daggers. Piper raised her hands in a placating gesture.
"Octavian, what happened at camp was a setup. We can explain."
"Can't hear you,"
Octavian yelled.
"Wax in our ears. Standard procedure when battling evil sirens. Now throw down your weapons and turn around slowly so I can bind your hands."
"Let me skewer him," Hazel muttered. "Please."
The ship was only 50 feet away, but Annabeth saw no sign of Coach Hedge on deck. He was probably below watching his stupid martial arts programs. Jason's group wasn't due back until sunset, and Percy would be underwater, unaware of the invasion. If Annabeth could get on board, she could use the ballistae. But there was no way to get around these three Romans. She was running out of time. The eagles circled overhead, crying out as if to alert their brethren. "Hey, some tasty Greek demigods over here!" Annabeth couldn't see the flying chariot anymore, but she assumed it was close by. She had to figure out something before more Romans arrived. She needed help. Some kind of distress signal to Coach Hedge, or even better, Percy.
"Well?"
Octavian demanded. His two friends brandished their swords. Very slowly, using only two fingers, Annabeth drew her dagger. Instead of dropping it, she tossed it as far as she could into the water. Octavian made a squeaking sound.
"What was that for? I didn't say toss it. That could have been evidence, or spoils of war."
Annabeth tried for a dumb blonde smile, like, "Oh, silly me." Nobody who knew her would have been fooled, but Octavian seemed to buy it. He huffed in exasperation.
"You other two,"
he pointed his blade at Hazel and Piper,
"put your weapons on the dock. No funny biz."
All around the Romans, Charleston Harbor erupted like a Las Vegas fountain putting on a show. When the wall of seawater subsided, the three Romans were in the bay, spluttering and frantically trying to stay afloat in their armor. Percy stood on the dock holding Annabeth's dagger.
"You drop this,"
he said, totally poker-faced. Annabeth threw her arms around him.
"I love you."
"Guys," Hazel interrupted. She had a little smile on her face.
"We need to hurry."
Down in the water, Octavian yelled,
"Get me out of here! I'll kill you!"
"Tempting,"
Percy called down.
"What?"
Octavian shouted. He was holding on to one of his guards, who was having trouble keeping them both afloat.
"Nothing,"
Percy shouted back.
"Let's go, guys."
Hazel frowned.
"We can't let them drown, can we?"
"They won't," Percy promised. "I've got the water circulating around their feet. As soon as we're out of range, I'll spit them ashore." Piper grinned.
"Nice."
They climbed aboard the Argo II, and Annabeth ran to the helm. Piper, get below. Use the sink in the galley for an Iris message. Warn Jason to get back here. Piper nodded and raced off. Hazel, go find Coach Hedge and tell him to get his furry hindquarters on deck.
Right.
And Percy, you and I need to get this ship to Fort Sumter. Percy nodded and ran to the mast. Annabeth took the helm. Her hands flew across the controls. She'd just have to hope she knew enough to operate them. Annabeth had seen Percy control full-sized sailing ships before with only his willpower. This time, he didn't disappoint. Ropes flew on their own, releasing the dock ties, weighing the anchor. The sails unfurled and caught the wind. Meanwhile, Annabeth fired the engine. The oars extended with a sound like machine gun fire, and the Argo II turned from the dock, heading for the island in the distance. The three eagles still circled overhead, but they made no attempt to land on the ship, probably because Festus the figurehead blew fire whenever they got close. More eagles were flying in formation toward Fort Sumter, at least a dozen. If each of them carried a Roman demigod, that was a lot of enemies. Coach Hedge came pounding up the stairs with Hazel at his hooves.
"Where are they?" he demanded. "Who do I kill?"
"No killing," Annabeth ordered. "Just defend the ship."
"But they interrupted a Chuck Norris movie."
Piper emerged from below.
"Got a message through to Jason. Kind of fuzzy, but he's already on his way. He should be... Oh, there!"
Soaring over the city, heading in their direction, was a giant bald eagle, unlike the golden Roman birds.
"Frank,"
Hazel said. Leo was holding on to the eagle's feet, and even from the ship, Annabeth could hear him screaming and cursing. Behind them flew Jason, riding the wind.
"Never seen Jason fly before," Percy grumbled. "He looks like a blonde Superman."
"This isn't the time," Piper scolded him. "Look, they're in trouble."
Sure enough, the Roman flying chariot had descended from a cloud and was diving straight toward them. Jason and Frank veered out of the way, pulling up to avoid getting trampled by the Pegasi. The charioteers fired their bows. Arrows whistled under Leo's feet, which led to more screaming and cursing. Jason and Frank were forced to overshoot the Argo II and fly toward Fort Sumter.
"I'll get 'em," yelled Coach Hedge.
He spun the port ballista. Before Annabeth could yell, "Don't be stupid," Hedge fired. A flaming spear rocketed toward the chariot. It exploded over the heads of the Pegasi and threw them into a panic. Unfortunately, it also singed Frank's wings and sent him spiraling out of control. Leo slipped from his grasp. The chariot shot toward Fort Sumter, slamming into Jason. Annabeth watched in horror as Jason, obviously dazed and in pain, lunged for Leo, caught him, then struggled to gain altitude. He only managed to slow their fall. They disappeared behind the ramparts of the fort. Frank tumbled after them. Then the chariot dropped somewhere inside and hit with a bone-shattering crack. One broken wheel spun into the air.
"Coach!" Piper screamed.
"What?" Hedge demanded. "That was just a warning shot."
Annabeth gunned the engines. The hull shuddered as they picked up speed. The docks of the island were only 100 yards away now, but a dozen more eagles were soaring overhead, each carrying a Roman demigod in its claws. The Argo II's crew would be outnumbered at least 3-1.
"Percy," Annabeth said, "we're going to come in hard. I need you to control the water so we don't smash into the docks. Once we're there, you're going to have to hold off the attackers. The rest of you help him guard the ship."
"But Jason,"
Piper said.
"Frank and Leo,"
Hazel added.
"I'll find them," Annabeth promised. "I've got to figure out where the map is, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only one who can do that."
"The fort is crawling with Romans," Percy warned. "You'll have to fight your way through. Find our friends, assuming they're okay. Find this map and get everybody back alive, all on your own."
"Just an average day,"
Annabeth kissed him.
"Whatever you do, don't let them take this ship."
Chapter 20. Annabeth. The new civil war had begun. Leo had somehow escaped his fall unharmed. Annabeth saw him ducking from portico to portico, blasting fire at the giant eagles swooping down on him. Roman demigods tried to chase him, tripping over piles of cannonballs and dodging tourists
who screamed and ran in circles. Tour guides kept yelling, "It's just a reenactment," though they didn't sound sure. The mist could only do so much to change what mortals saw. In the middle of the courtyard, a full-grown elephant, could that be Frank, rampaged around the flagpoles, scattering Roman warriors. Jason stood about 50 yards away, sword fighting with a stocky centurion whose lips were stained cherry red like blood. A wannabe vampire, or maybe a Kool-Aid freak? As Annabeth watched, Jason yelled, "Sorry about this, Dakota!" He vaulted straight over the centurion's head like an acrobat and slammed the hilt of his gladius into the back of the Roman's head. Dakota crumpled.
"Jason!"
Annabeth called. He scanned the battlefield until he saw her. She pointed to where the Argo II was docked.
"Get the others aboard! Retreat!"
"What about you?" he called.
"Don't wait for me!"
Annabeth bolted off before he could protest. She had a hard time maneuvering through the mobs of tourists. Why did so many people want to see Fort Sumter on a sweltering summer day? But Annabeth quickly realized the crowds had saved their lives. Without the chaos of all these panicked mortals, the Romans would have already surrounded their outnumbered crew. Annabeth dodged into a small room that must have been part of the garrison. She tried to steady her breathing. She imagined what it would have been like to be a Union soldier on this island in 1861, surrounded by enemies, dwindling food and supplies, no reinforcements coming. Some of the Union defenders had been children of Athena. They'd hidden an important map here, something they didn't want falling into enemy hands. If Annabeth had been one of those demigods, where would she have put it? Suddenly the walls glistened. The air became warm. Annabeth wondered if she was hallucinating. She was about to run for the exit when the door slammed shut. The mortar between the stones blistered. The bubbles popped, and thousands of tiny black spiders swelled forth. Annabeth couldn't move. Her heart seemed to have stopped. The spiders blanketed the walls, crawling over one another, spreading across the floor and gradually surrounding her. It was impossible. This couldn't be real. Terror plunged her into memories. She was 7 years old again, alone in her bedroom in Richmond, Virginia. The spiders came at night. They crawled in waves from her closet and waited in the shadows. She yelled for her father, but her father was away for work. He always seemed to be away for work. Her stepmother came instead. "I don't mind being the bad cop," she had once told Annabeth's father, when she didn't think Annabeth could hear. "It's only your imagination," her stepmother said about the spiders. "You're scaring your baby brothers." "They're not my brothers," Annabeth argued, which made her stepmother's expression harden. Her eyes were almost as scary as the spiders. "Go to sleep now," her stepmother insisted. "No more screaming." The spiders came back as soon as her stepmother had left the room. Annabeth tried to hide under the covers, but it was no good. Eventually, she fell asleep from sheer exhaustion. She woke up in the morning, freckled with bites, cobwebs covering her eyes, her mouth, and nose. The bites faded before she even got dressed, so she had nothing to show her stepmother except cobwebs, which her stepmother thought was some sort of clever trick. "No more talk of spiders," her stepmother said firmly. "You're a big girl now." The second night, the spiders came again. Her stepmother continued to be the bad cop. Annabeth wasn't allowed to call her father and bother him with this nonsense. No, he would not come home early. The third night, Annabeth ran away from home. Later, at Camp Half-Blood, she learned that all children of Athena feared spiders. Long ago, Athena had taught the mortal weaver Arachne a hard lesson, cursing her for her pride by turning her into the first spider. Ever since, spiders had hated the children of Athena. But that didn't make her fear easier to deal with. Once, she'd almost killed Connor Stoll at camp for putting a tarantula in her bunk. Years later, she'd had a panic attack at a water park in Denver when Percy and she were assaulted by mechanical spiders. In the past few weeks, Annabeth had dreamed of spiders almost every night, crawling over her, suffocating her, wrapping her in webs. Now, standing in the barracks at Fort Sumter, she was surrounded. Her nightmares had come true.
A sleepy voice murmured in her head.
Soon, my dear, you will meet the weaver soon.
Gia?
Annabeth murmured. She feared the answer, but she asked,
Who is the weaver?
The spiders became excited, swarming over the walls, swirling around Annabeth's feet like a glistening black whirlpool. Only the hope that it might be an illusion kept Annabeth from passing out from fear.
I hope you survive, child,
the woman's voice said.
I would prefer you as my sacrifice, but we must let the weaver take her revenge.
Gia's voice faded. On the far wall in the center of the spider swarm, a red symbol blazed to life. The figure of an owl, like the one on the silver drachma, staring straight at Annabeth. Then, just as in her nightmares, the mark of Athena burned across the walls, incinerating the spiders until the room was empty, except for the smell of sickly sweet ashes.
Go,
said a new voice, Annabeth's mother.
Avenge me. Follow the mark.
The blazing symbol of the owl faded. The garrison door burst open. Annabeth stood stunned in the middle of the room, unsure whether she'd seen something real or just a vision. An explosion shook the building. Annabeth remembered that her friends were in danger. She'd stayed here much too long. She forced herself to move, still trembling. She stumbled outside. The ocean air helped clear her mind. She gazed across the courtyard, past the panicked tourists and fighting demigods, to the edge of the battlements, where a large mortar pointed out to sea. It may have been Annabeth's imagination, but the old artillery piece seemed to be glowing red. She dashed toward it. An eagle swooped at her, but she ducked and kept running. Nothing could possibly scare her as much as those spiders. Roman demigods had formed ranks and were advancing toward the Argo too, but a miniature storm had gathered over their heads. Though the day was clear all around them, thunder rumbled and lightning flashed above the Romans. Rain and wind pushed them back. Annabeth didn't stop to think about it. She reached the mortar and put her hand on the muzzle. On the plug that blocked the opening, the mark of Athena began to glow. The red outline of an owl.
In the mortar, she said. Of course!
She pried at the plug with her fingers. No luck. Cursing, she drew her dagger. As soon as the celestial bronze touched the plug shrank and loosened. Annabeth pulled it off and stuck her hand inside the cannon. Her fingers touched something cold, smooth, and metal. She pulled out a small disc of bronze the size of a tea saucer, etched with delicate letters and illustrations. She decided to examine it later. She thrust it in her pack and turned.
Rushing off?
Reyna asked. The praetor stood 10 feet away, in full battle armor, holding a golden javelin. Her two metal greyhounds growled at her side. Annabeth scanned the area. They were more or less alone. Most of the combat had moved toward the docks. Hopefully her friends had all made it on board, but they'd have to set sail immediately or risk being overrun. Annabeth had to hurry.
Reyna, she said, what happened at Camp Jupiter was Gia's fault. Eidolons, possessing spirits, save your explanations, Reyna said. You'll need them for the trial.
The dogs snarled and inched forward. This time it didn't seem to matter to them that Annabeth was telling the truth. She tried to think of an escape plan. She doubted she could take Reyna in one-on-one combat. With those metal dogs, she stood no chance at all.
If you let Gia drive our camps apart, Annabeth said, the giants have already won. They'll destroy the Romans, the Greeks, the gods, the whole mortal world. Don't you think I know that?
Rena's voice was as hard as iron.
What choice have you left me? Octavian smells blood. He's whipped the Legion into a frenzy, and I can't stop it. Surrender to me. I'll bring you back to New Rome for trial. It won't be fair. You'll be painfully executed. But it may be enough to stop further violence. Octavian won't be satisfied, of course, but I think I can convince the others to stand down. It wasn't me! It doesn't matter! Reyna snapped. Someone must pay for what happened. Let it be you. It's the better option.
Annabeth's skin crawled. Better than what?
Use that wisdom of yours, Raina said. If you escape today, we won't follow. I told you, not even a madman would cross the sea to the ancient lands. If Octavian can't have vengeance on your ship, he'll turn his attention to Camp Half-Blood. The Legion will march on your territory. We will raise it and salt the earth.
Kill the Romans, she heard her mother urging. They can never be your allies.
Annabeth wanted to sob. Camp Half-Blood was the only real home she'd ever known. And in a bid for friendship, she had told Raina exactly where to find it. She couldn't leave it at the mercy of the Romans and travel halfway around the world. But their quest and everything she'd suffered to get Percy back, if she didn't go to the ancient lands, it would all mean nothing. Besides, the Mark of Athena didn't have to lead to revenge.
If I could find the route, her mother had said, the way home.
How will you use your reward?
Aphrodite had asked.
For war or peace?
There was an answer. The Mark of Athena could lead her there, if she survived. I'm going, she told Raina. I'm following the Mark of Athena to Rome. The praetor shook her head.
You have no idea what awaits you.
Yes, I do, Annabeth said. This grudge between our camps, I can fix it.
Our grudge is thousands of years old. How can one person fix it?
Annabeth wished she could give a convincing answer, show Raina a 3D diagram or a brilliant schematic, but she couldn't. She just knew she had to try. She remembered that lost look on her mother's face.
I must return home.
The quest has to succeed, she said. You can try to stop me, in which case we'll have to fight to the death. Or you can let me go, and I'll try to save both our camps. If you must march on Camp Half-Blood, at least try to delay. Slow Octavian down.
Raina's eyes narrowed.
One daughter of a war goddess to another. I respect your boldness. But if you leave now, you doom your camp to destruction.
Don't underestimate Camp Half-Blood, Annabeth warned.
You've never seen the Legion at war, Raina countered.
Over by the docks, a familiar voice shrieked over the wind.
Kill them! Kill them all!
Octavian had survived his swim in the harbor. He crouched behind his guards, screaming encouragement at the other Roman demigods as they struggled toward the ship, holding up their shields as if that would deflect the storm raging all around them. On the deck of the Argo II, Percy and Jason stood together, their swords crossed. Annabeth got a tingle down her spine as she realized the boys were working as one, summoning the sky and the sea to do their bidding. Water and wind churned together. Waves heaved against the ramparts and lightning flashed. Giant eagles were knocked out of the sky. Wreckage of the flying chariot burned in the water. And Coach Hedge swung a mounted crossbow, taking pot shots at the Roman birds as they flew overhead.
You see, Raina said bitterly, the spear is thrown. Our people are at war.
Not if I succeed, Annabeth said. Raina's expression looked the same as it had at Camp Jupiter when she realized Jason had found another girl. The praetor was too alone, too bitter and betrayed to believe anything could go right for her ever again. Annabeth waited for her to attack. Instead, Raina flicked her hand. The metal dogs backed away.
Annabeth Chase, she said. When we meet again, we will be enemies on the field of battle.
The praetor turned and walked across the ramparts, her greyhounds behind her. Annabeth feared it might be some sort of trick, but she had no time to wonder. She ran for the ship. The winds that battered the Romans didn't seem to affect her. Annabeth sprinted through their lines. Octavian yelled,
"Stop her!"
A spear flew past her ear. The Argo II was already pulling away from the dock. Piper was at the gangplank, her hand outstretched. Annabeth leaped and grabbed Piper's hand. The gangplank fell into the sea and the two girls tumbled onto the deck.
Go!
Annabeth screamed.
Go, go, go!
The engines rumbled beneath her. The oars churned. Jason changed the course of the wind, and Percy called up a massive wave which lifted the ship higher than the fort's walls and pushed it out to sea. By the time the Argo II reached top speed, Fort Sumter was only a blot in the distance, and they were racing across the waves toward the ancient lands. Chapter 21 Leo. After raiding a museum full of Confederate ghosts, Leo didn't think his day could get any worse. He was wrong. They hadn't found anything in the Civil War sub or elsewhere in the museum, just a few elderly tourists, a dozing security guard, and, when they tried to inspect the artifacts, a whole battalion of glowing zombie dudes in gray uniforms. The idea that Frank should be able to control the spirits? Yeah, that pretty much failed. By the time Piper sent her Iris message warning them about the Roman attack, they were already halfway back to the ship, having been chased through downtown Charleston by a pack of angry dead Confederates. Then, oh boy, Leo got to hitch a ride with Frank, the friendly eagle, so they could fight a bunch of Romans. Rumor must have gotten around that Leo was the one who had fired on their little city, because those Romans seemed especially anxious to kill him. But wait, there was more. Coach Hedge shot them out of the sky. Frank dropped him, that was no accident, and they crash-landed in Fort Sumter. Now, as the Argo II raced across the waves, Leo had to use all his skill just to keep the ship in one piece. Percy and Jason were a little too good at cooking up massive storms. At one point, Annabeth stood next to him, yelling against the roar of the wind. "Percy says he talked to a Nereid in Charleston Harbor." "Good for him," Leo yelled back. "The Nereid said we should seek help from Chiron's brothers." "What does that mean? The party ponies?" Leo had never met Chiron's crazy centaur relatives, but he'd heard rumors of Nerf sword fights, root beer, chugging contests, and super soakers filled with pressurized whipped cream. "Not sure," Annabeth said, "but I've got coordinates. Can you input latitude and longitude in this thing?"
"I can input star charts and order you a smoothie if you want. Of course I can do latitude and longitude."
Annabeth rattled off the numbers. Leo somehow managed to punch them in while holding the wheel with one hand. A red dot popped up on the bronze display screen.
"That location is in the middle of the Atlantic," he said. "Do the party ponies have a yacht?"
Annabeth shrugged helplessly.
"Just hold the ship together until we get farther from Charleston. Jason and Percy will keep up the winds."
"Happy fun time!"
It seemed like forever, but finally the sea calmed and the winds died.
"Valdez," said Coach Hedge, with surprising gentleness, "let me take the wheel. You've been steering for 2 hours.
2 hours?
"Yeah, give me the wheel."
"Coach?"
"Yeah, kid."
"I can't unclench my hands."
It was true. Leo's fingers felt like they had turned to stone. His eyes burned from staring at the horizon. His knees were marshmallows. Coach Hedge managed to pry him from the wheel. Leo took one last look at the console, listening to Festus chatter and whir a status report. Leo felt like he was forgetting something. He stared at the controls, trying to think, but it was no good. His eyes could hardly focus.
"Just watch for monsters," he told the coach. "And be careful with the damaged stabilizer, and..."
"I've got it covered," Coach Hedge promised. "Now go away!"
Leo nodded wearily. He staggered across the deck toward his friends. Percy and Jason sat with their backs against the mast, their heads slumped in exhaustion. Annabeth and Piper were trying to get them to drink some water. Hazel and Frank stood just out of earshot, having an argument that involved lots of arm-waving and head-shaking. Leo should not have felt pleased about that, but part of him did. The other part of him felt bad that he felt pleased. The argument stopped abruptly when Hazel saw Leo. Everybody gathered at the mast. Frank scowled like he was trying hard to turn into a bulldog.
"No sign of pursuit," he said.
"Or land," Hazel added.
She looked a little green, though Leo wasn't sure if that was from the rocking of the boat or from arguing. Leo scanned the horizon. Nothing but ocean in every direction. That shouldn't have surprised him. He'd spent 6 months building a ship that he knew would cross the Atlantic. But until today, their embarking on a journey to the ancient lands hadn't seemed real. Leo had never been outside the U.S. before, except for a quick dragon flight up to Quebec. Now they were in the middle of the open sea, completely on their own, sailing to the Mare Nostrum, where all the scary monsters and nasty giants had come from. The Romans might not follow them, but they couldn't count on any help from Camp Half-Blood either. Leo patted his waist to make sure his tool belt was still there. Unfortunately, that just reminded him of Nemesis's fortune cookie, tucked inside one of the pockets.
"You will always be an outsider,"
the goddess's voice still wriggled around in his head.
"The seventh wheel."
"Forget her," Leo told himself. "Concentrate on the stuff you can fix." He turned to Annabeth.
"Did you find the map you wanted?"
She nodded, though she looked pale. Leo wondered what she'd seen at Fort Sumter that could have shaken her up so badly. "I'll have to study it," she said, as if that was the end of the subject. "How far are we from those coordinates?"
"At top rowing speed, about an hour," Leo said. "Any idea what we're looking for?"
"No," she admitted. "Percy?" Percy raised his head. His green eyes were bloodshot and droopy.
"The Nereid said Chiron's brothers were there, and they'd want to hear about that aquarium in Atlanta. I don't know what she meant, but..."
He paused, like he'd used up all his energy saying that much.
"She also warned me to be careful. Keto, the goddess at the aquarium, she's the mother of sea monsters. She might be stuck in Atlanta, but she can still send her children after us. The Nereid said we should expect an attack."
"Wonderful," Frank muttered. Jason tried to stand, which wasn't a good idea. Piper grabbed him to keep him from falling over, and he slid back down the mast.
"Can we get the ship aloft?" he asked. "If we could fly..."
"That'd be great," Leo said. "Except Festus tells me the port aerial stabilizer got pulverized when the ship raked against the dock at Fort Sumter."
"We were in a hurry," Annabeth said, "trying to save you."
"And saving me is a very noble cause," Leo agreed. "I'm just saying, it'll take some time to fix. Until then, we're not flying anywhere."
Percy flexed his shoulders and winced.
"Fine with me. The sea is good."
"Speak for yourself." Hazel glanced at the evening sun, which was almost to the horizon. "We need to go fast. We've burned another day and Nico only has 3 more left."
"We can do it," Leo promised.
He hoped Hazel had forgiven him for not trusting her brother. Hey, it had seemed like a reasonable suspicion to Leo, but he didn't want to reopen that wound.
"We can make it to Rome in 3 days, assuming, you know, nothing unexpected happens."
Frank grunted. He looked like he was still working on that bulldog transformation.
"Is there any good news?"
"Actually, yes," Leo said. "According to Festus, our flying table, Buford, made it back safely while we were in Charleston, so those eagles didn't get him. Unfortunately, he lost the laundry bag with your pants."
"Dang it!"
Frank barked, which Leo figured was probably severe profanity for him. No doubt Frank would have cursed some more, busting out the golly gees and the gosh darns, but Percy interrupted by doubling over and groaning.
"Did the world just turn upside down?" he asked.
Jason pressed his hands to his head.
"Yeah, and it's spinning. Everything is yellow."
"Is it supposed to be yellow?"
Annabeth and Piper exchanged concerned looks.
"Summoning that storm really sapped your strength," Piper told the boys. "You've got to rest."
Annabeth nodded agreement. "Frank, can you help us get the guys below decks?" Frank glanced at Leo, no doubt reluctant to leave him alone with Hazel.
"It's fine, man," Leo said. "Just try not to drop them on the way down the stairs."
Once the others were below, Hazel and Leo faced each other awkwardly.
They were alone except for Coach Hedge, who was back on the quarterdeck singing the Pokemon theme song. The coach had changed the words to, "Gotta kill 'em all," and Leo really didn't want to know why. The song didn't seem to help Hazel's nausea.
Ugh.
She leaned over and hugged her sides. She had nice hair, frizzy and golden brown like curls of cinnamon. Her hair reminded Leo of a place in Houston that made excellent churros. The thought made him hungry.
"Don't lean over," he advised. "Don't close your eyes. It makes the queasiness worse."
"It does? Do you get seasick too?"
"Not seasick, but cars make me nauseous, and..."
He stopped himself. He wanted to say talking to girls, but he decided to keep that to himself.
"Cars?"
Hazel straightened with difficulty.
"You can sail a ship or fly a dragon, but cars make you sick?"
"I know, right?" Leo shrugged. "I'm special that way. Look, keep your eyes on the horizon. That's a fixed point. It'll help."
Hazel took a deep breath and stared into the distance. Her eyes were lustrous gold, like the copper and bronze discs inside Festus's mechanical head.
"Any better?"
he asked.
"Maybe a little."
She sounded like she was just being polite. She kept her eyes on the horizon, but Leo got the feeling she was gauging his mood, considering what to say.
"Frank didn't drop you on purpose," she said. "He's not like that. He's just a little clumsy sometimes."
"Oops," Leo said in his best Frank Jong voice. "Dropped Leo into a squad of enemy soldiers. Dang it."
Hazel tried to suppress a smile. Leo figured smiling was better than throwing up.
"Go easy on him," Hazel said. "You and your fireballs make Frank nervous."
"The guy can turn into an elephant, and I make him nervous?"
Hazel kept her eyes on the horizon. She didn't look quite so queasy, despite the fact that Coach Hedge was still singing his Pokemon song at the helm.
"Leo," she said, "about what happened at the Great Salt Lake."
Here it comes, Leo thought. He remembered their meeting with the revenge goddess Nemesis. The fortune cookie in his tool belt started to feel heavier. Last night as they flew from Atlanta, Leo had lain in his cabin and thought about how angry he'd made Hazel. He thought about ways he could make it right.
"Soon you will face a problem you cannot solve," Nemesis had said. "Though I could help you for a price."
Leo had taken the fortune cookie out of his tool belt and turned it in his fingers, wondering what price he would have to pay if he broke it open. Maybe now was the moment.
"I'd be willing," he told Hazel. "I could use the fortune cookie to find your brother."
Hazel looked stunned.
"What? No. I mean, I'd never ask you to do that. Not after what Nemesis said about the horrible cost. We barely know each other."
The barely know each other comment kind of hurt, though Leo knew it was true.
"So, that's not what you wanted to talk about?" he asked. Did you want to talk about the holding hands on the boulder moment? Because..."
"No,"
she said quickly, fanning her face in that cute way she did when she was flustered.
"No, I was just thinking about the way you tricked Narcissus and those nymphs."
"Oh, right."
Leo glanced self-consciously at his arm. The hot stuff tattoo hadn't completely faded.
"Seemed like a good idea at the time."
"You were amazing," Hazel said. "I've been mulling it over. How much you reminded me of..."
"Sammy," Leo guessed. "I wish you'd tell me who he is."
"Who he was," Hazel corrected.
The evening air was warm, but she shivered.
"I've been thinking. I might be able to show you."
"You mean like a photo?"
"No. There's a sort of flashback that happens to me. I haven't had one in a long time, and I've never tried to make one happen on purpose. But I shared one with Frank once, so I thought..."
Hazel locked eyes with him. Leo started to feel jittery, like he'd been injected with coffee. If this flashback was something Frank had shared with Hazel, well, either Leo didn't want any part of it, or he definitely wanted to try it. He wasn't sure which.
"When you say flashback," he swallowed, "what exactly are we talking about? Is it safe?"
Hazel held out her hand.
I wouldn't ask you to do this, but I'm sure it's important. It can't be a coincidence we met. If this works, maybe we can finally understand how we're connected.
Leo glanced back at the helm. He still had a nagging suspicion he'd forgotten something, but Coach Hedge seemed to be doing fine. The sky ahead was clear. There was no sign of trouble. Besides, a flashback sounded like a pretty brief thing. It couldn't hurt to let the coach be in charge for a few more minutes, could it?
Okay, he relented. Show me.
He took Hazel's hand, and the world dissolved. Chapter 22. Leo. They stood in the courtyard of an old compound like a monastery. Red brick walls were overgrown with vines. Big magnolia trees had cracked the pavement. The sun beat down and the humidity was about 200%, even stickier than in Houston. Somewhere nearby, Leo smelled fish frying. Overhead, the cloud cover was low and gray, striped like a tiger's pelt. The courtyard was about the size of a basketball court. An old deflated football sat in one corner at the base of a Virgin Mary statue. Along the sides of the buildings, windows were open. Leo could see flickers of movement inside, but it was eerily quiet. He saw no sign of air conditioning, which meant it must have been 1,000 degrees in there.
"Where are we?"
he asked.
"My old school,"
Hazel said next to him.
"St. Agnes Academy for Colored Children and Indians."
"What kind of name?"
He turned toward Hazel and yelped. She was a ghost. Just a vaporous silhouette in the steamy air. Leo looked down and realized his own body had turned to mist, too. Everything around him seemed solid and real, but he was a spirit. After having been possessed by an Eidolon 3 days ago, he didn't appreciate the feeling. Before he could ask questions, a bell rang inside. Not a modern electronic sound, but the old-fashioned buzz of a hammer on metal.
"This is a memory," Hazel said, "so no one will see us. Look, here we come."
"We?"
From every door, dozens of children spilled into the courtyard, yelling and jostling each other. They were mostly African-American, with a sprinkling of Hispanic-looking kids, as young as kindergartners and as old as high schoolers. Leo could tell this was in the past, because all the girls wore dresses and buckled leather shoes. The boys wore white-collared shirts and pants held up by suspenders. Many wore caps like horse jockeys wear. Some kids carried lunches. Many didn't. Their clothes were clean, but worn and faded. Some had holes in the knees of their trousers or shoes with the heels coming apart. A few of the girls began playing jump rope with an old piece of clothesline. The older guys tossed a ratty baseball back and forth. Kids with lunches sat together and ate and chatted. No one paid Ghost Hazel or Leo any attention. Then Hazel from the past, stepped into the courtyard. Leo recognized her with no problem, though she looked about 2 years younger than now. Her hair was pinned back in a bun. Her gold eyes darted around the courtyard uneasily. She wore a dark dress, unlike the other girls in their white cotton or pastel flowery prints, so she stood out like a mourner at a wedding. She gripped a canvas lunch bag and moved along the wall as if trying hard not to be noticed. It didn't work. A boy called out, "Witch girl!" He lumbered toward her, backing her into a corner. The boy could have been 14 or 19. It was hard to tell because he was so big and tall, easily the largest guy on the playground. Leo figured he'd been held back a few times. He wore a dirty shirt the color of grease rags, threadbare wool trousers. In this heat, they couldn't have been comfortable. And no shoes at all. Maybe the teachers were too terrified to insist that this kid wear shoes, or maybe he just didn't have any.
"That's Rufus," said Ghost Hazel with distaste.
"Seriously? No way his name is Rufus," Leo said.
"Come on," said Ghost Hazel.
She drifted toward the confrontation. Leo followed. He wasn't used to drifting, but he'd ridden a Segway once and it was kind of like that. He simply leaned the direction he wanted to go and glided along. The big kid, Rufus, had flat features as if he spent most of his time face-planting on the sidewalk.
His hair was cut just as flat on top, so miniature airplanes could have used it for a landing strip. Rufus thrust out his hand.
Lunch!
Hazel from the past didn't protest. She handed over her canvas bag like this was an everyday occurrence. A few older girls drifted over to watch the fun. One giggled at Rufus.
You don't want to eat that, she warned. It's probably poison.
You're right, Rufus said. Did your witch mom make this, Levesque?
She's not a witch, Hazel muttered.
Rufus dropped the bag and stepped on it, smashing the contents under his bare heel.
You can have it back. I want a diamond, though. I hear your mama can make those out of thin air. Give me a diamond.
I don't have diamonds, Hazel said. Go away.
Rufus balled his fists. Leo had been in enough rough schools and foster homes to sense when things were about to turn ugly. He wanted to step in and help Hazel, but he was a ghost. Besides, all this had happened decades ago. Then another kid stumbled outside into the sunlight. Leo sucked in his breath. The boy looked exactly like him.
You see? Asked Ghost Hazel.
Fake Leo was the same height as regular Leo, meaning he was short. He had the same nervous energy, tapping his fingers against his trousers, brushing at his white cotton shirt, adjusting the jockey cap on his curly brown hair. Really, Leo thought, short people should not wear jockey caps unless they were jockeys. Fake Leo had the same devilish smile that greeted regular Leo whenever he looked in a mirror. An expression that made teachers immediately shout, "Don't even think about it," and plop him in the front row. Apparently, fake Leo had just been scolded by a teacher. He was holding a dunce cap. An honest-to-goodness cardboard cone that said, "Dunce." Leo thought those were something you only saw in cartoons. He could understand why fake Leo wasn't wearing it. Bad enough to look like a jockey. With that cone on his head, he would have looked like a gnome. Some kids backed up when fake Leo burst onto the scene. Others nudged each other and ran toward him like they were expecting a show. Meanwhile, flathead Rufus was still trying to punk Hazel out of a diamond, oblivious to fake Leo's arrival.
Come on, girl!
Rufus loomed over Hazel with his fists clenched.
Give it!
Hazel pressed herself against the wall. Suddenly the ground at her feet went snap, like a twig breaking. A perfect diamond, the size of a pistachio, glittered between her feet.
Ha!
Rufus barked when he saw it. He started to lean down, but Hazel yelped,
No, please!
As if she was genuinely concerned for the big goon. That's when fake Leo strolled over. Here it comes, Leo thought. Fake Leo is going to bust out some Coach Hedge-style jiu-jitsu and save the day. Instead, fake Leo put the top of the dunce cap to his mouth like a megaphone and yelled,
Cut!
He said it with such authority all the other kids momentarily froze. Even Rufus straightened and backed away in confusion. One of the little boys snickered under his breath.
Hammy Sammy.
Sammy. Leo shivered. Who the heck was this kid? Sammy slash fake Leo stormed up to Rufus with his dunce cap in his hand, looking angry.
No, 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 he announced, waving his free hand wildly at the other kids who were gathering to watch the entertainment.
Sammy turned to Hazel.
Miss Lamar, your line is...
Sammy looked around in exasperation.
Script! What is Hetty Lamar's line?
No, please, you villain,
one of the boys called out.
Thank you, Sammy said. Miss Lamar, you're supposed to say, No, please, you villain. And you, Clark Gable.
The whole courtyard burst into laughter. Leo vaguely knew Clark Gable was an old-timey actor, but he didn't know much else. Apparently, though, the idea that Flathead Rufus could be Clark Gable was hilarious to the kids.
Mr. Gable.
No,
one of the girls cried.
Make him Gary Cooper.
More laughter. Rufus looked as if he were about to blow a valve. He balled his fists like he wanted to hit somebody, but he couldn't attack the entire school. He clearly hated being laughed at. But his slow little mind couldn't quite work out what Sammy was up to. Leo nodded in appreciation.
Sammy was like him.
Leo had done the same kind of stuff to bullies for years.
Right, Sammy yelled imperiously. Mr. Cooper, you say, oh, but